Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Healthy Gut Podcast with Rebecca Coombs, the place where you can learn how to achieve a happy, healthy gut. Here's what's coming up on today's show. Welcome to episode 65 of the Healthy Gut Podcast. If you haven't already listened to my live interview with Dr. Mark Pimentel from last week, I strongly recommend you go back and take a listen to that. That's episode 64. Dr. Pimentel joined me live in Los Angeles to talk about his groundbreaking research on hydrogen sulfide SIBO, the third gas of SIBO, which up until recently has not been able to be identified. So it was a fascinating discussion with Dr. Pimentel, and he also answered a whole heap of questions that my listeners had submitted. So go back and listen to episode 64. I've been really busy. I've just returned from the United States, where I attended the SIBO Symposium in Portland, Oregon. It was a fantastic event filled with amazing speakers talking about all sorts of new and interesting things that we should be considering when it comes to digestive health. So I do look forward to sharing a wrap-up of that event with you very shortly. Coming up on today's show, we're joined by Chris Gebhardt, who is actually one of my own naturopaths. I'm so lucky to have him in Melbourne, Australia with me. And we talk about the important topic of life after SIBO. We get so fixated on the actual SIBO treatment that we often forget to think what happens beyond SIBO and how we should be approaching that. So Chris and I chat about that, and I'm sure you will find this absolutely fascinating. He is a wealth of knowledge. Chris is a registered acupuncturist and naturopath, and since graduating as a naturopath in 1995, he has gone on to practice and study extensively, including an undergraduate degree in acupuncture and postgraduate studies in Japanese acupuncture, Emmett technique, and internship at the Guangxi TCM Hospital in China. Chris delivers a unique style of physical therapy that offers quick and lasting relief to a broad range of musculoskeletal issues. He also works closely with Natalie Crutterden, my other naturopath, in the care of patients with fertility issues and SIBO. Chris is also highly sought after as a practitioner for those suffering from chronic and complex digestive disorders. If you would like to get access to the show notes from today's episode, they're available at thehealthygut.co/life-after-SIBO. And don't forget, guys, if you would like a full transcription of this episode, you can get it by signing up for free as a member of the Healthy Gut Podcast. There's absolutely zero cost to sign up. All you need to do is pop your name and email address on the show notes page, and you will be emailed with the transcription from today's episode and every episode in season two. So without further ado, here is Chris Gebhardt and I talking about life after SIBO. Welcome to the Healthy Gut Podcast. Chris, it's great to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
And we are going to be talking about life after SIBO. There's so much focus spent for those of us with SIBO on living with SIBO, dealing with SIBO, treating SIBO, that sometimes we forget what happens next. And that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah. So I guess this conversation came up between us because we had done a webinar on this subject. So we're going to try and cover some of that stuff again. And so we'll see how we go. So the main reason that I thought it would be an interesting topic is that often amongst forums and other podcasts that I've seen around, there isn't so much information about what happens afterwards, other than, you know, the use of prokinetics and a lot of waiting and seeing what happens and then possibly retreating SIBO. So I just wanted to maybe talk a little bit about in our practice how that differs a little bit, particularly in the way that I think or what happens to cause SIBO. And then also, as a follow-on to that, I thought it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about my experience with my patients and FODMAP intolerances and how I think that that's tied in with dysfunction and structural change in the small bowel as a result of having SIBO, and then what I've seen in my patients after having done some repair work after clearing SIBO, and the fact that a lot of my patients can once again have FODMAP foods, which is pretty exciting. But again, you don't hear a lot about that. So I thought it's a really interesting topic to talk about because it's relevant to anyone who has SIBO. And also just about improving gut function afterwards. One of the things that we talked about last time was that there's a lot of emphasis, particularly in the research around SIBO, about clearing the SIBO and then this idea that it is a chronic relapsing condition. So, and while that is true and while a lot of people do relapse, I was a little surprised at the numbers that they talk about because that wasn't reflected in our practice. Certainly there are patients who do, and as you know, everyone's different. What people do afterwards is different. And some people, once they've finished the SIBO treatment, will then stop everything and maybe make some, you know, some more permanent dietary changes as a result of that, but and then, you know, pretty much leave it. And those are the patients that will typically come back with symptoms again. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about those patients that do go on and do the gut repair program certainly I can speak for myself and to somewhat Natalie, my partner, and the work that we do here. And also we were going to have a little bit of a chat about something that we've been doing for probably around 4 or 5 months here, or maybe even 6 months, based on a workshop that I did sort of mid last year with Jason Horlick, in interpreting and looking at the eubiome testing, which is pretty exciting, which is that DNA testing of stool culture or stool bacteria, I should say. So, and looking at the implications of that for long-term gut health and SIBO as well.
I am fascinated by it, and yourself, Natalie, and I, you two being my naturopaths who look after me, we've just recently got my results in for the eubiome test, and I'm so interested in it. But let's start off with, I'd really like to hear your thoughts or your clinical experience around relapse rates, because it is quoted that 2/3 of SIBO patients will relapse. And I'll share with you what I believe is one of the causes of that. And because of what I see and hear from SIBO patients that contact me from all around the world, and that is there seems to be not enough focus on what's next and also what caused the SIBO. It feels to me that SIBO treatment is quite topical in the sense that, oh, you've got an overgrowth of bacteria, let's kill off the excess bacteria. Not you've got adhesions or your stomach acid is not at the right pH level or you've had, you know, whatever it is.
Yep.
And let's address those things as well as the fact that you've got an overgrowth of bacteria. And I suspect that that's why relapse is so high, because the underlying cause or causes is just not being addressed. And of course, then the SIBO returns.
Yep.
Would you, do you feel that my theory there is kind of is fair in assuming that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a really interesting topic, because I know there's a lot of talk around about the autoimmune aspect, or, you know, it's sort of more of a theoretical sort of model for what causes that dysfunction in the migrating motor complex, which is thought to be behind why there is an overgrowth in bacteria in the small bowel, which shouldn't really be there. So it is normal to have some small amounts of bacteria in the small bowel, but we're talking about those amounts that produce excess gas, which you would normally find on a positive SIBO test, breath test for lactulose or glucose. It's actually really interesting to see. I use the lactulose test mostly in my practice, it's quite an interesting little test in itself, because in some cases where you've got a SIBO positive test, which is where you don't have high baseline levels, which can be a little bit complicated, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But in that normal positive test where you've got slightly elevated, maybe low levels in the first sort of three tests, and then at around the 40-60 minute mark in the test, you see the beginnings of elevation of either hydrogen or methane, and that can also go down. So we're looking at a rise of methane or hydrogen within the first 120 minutes. And so for me, given that we know, you know, with some accuracy, obviously it's not a perfect test, but if we say, for argument's sake, that it does take 120 minutes to get to the end of the small bowel and the ileocecal valve, which is, you know, that junction of the large and small bowel, that if you see the gas production, you know, sort of relatively low until later on in the test, so looking at sort of, you know, 100 to 120 minutes, and you see that spike, that usually indicates to me that there's probably more of an issue with the distal small bowel. And given that the small intestine is a pipe, there's only two ways you can get into it, and that's from the stomach or from the large intestine. And so that tells me already that there's potentially issues with either, as you mentioned before, low stomach acid, which is a higher pH, or potentially an issue with the regulation or function of the ileocecal valve, which is sort of like a trapdoor. It should be a one-way valve, but in some people it becomes dysfunctional and stays open for too long. And that allows for bacteria to flow in a retrograde way and start to colonize the small bowel. I don't know how far up they can actually travel. I like to think that they don't go all that far. So the patients where I see high levels up in the, you know, around the 40-60 minute mark, often that equates with the symptoms they're experiencing. So I find that they're the people that have often lots of substernal, sort of just under the diaphragm pressure, and a lot of their symptoms are in the upper part where they're getting, you know, maybe it's indigestion, burping, reflux, it associated with that feeling of bloating and fullness. And so in those patients, I'm always curious, and sometimes in the history you can see that either they've had a history of using proton pump inhibitors, which reduce the production of stomach acid, in which case you're pretty much opening the front door to the small intestine. And but in other people, that unfortunately we can't test it in this country, but certainly through symptoms we can ascertain whether there's a likelihood that they're suffering from hypochlorhydria, which is that lower stomach acid, which if you think of the stomach as a fiery cauldron, it's the first line of defense, because once it gets past the stomach, you're basically in immune territory. And so that's like the, you know, the moat to the castle, and if invaders can cross that and get into the castle, then, you know, the potential effects there are quite vast. And so that talks to food intolerances where proteins aren't being digested properly, which is often an accompanying issue with SIBO and digestive dysfunction. Yeah, so, but anyway, so that idea that the stomach is not functioning properly is a really important one. And I see in my practice when we start to increase that, usually initially through supplementation, but it ties in with another one of my favorite things, which is zinc. And there's an enzyme that's responsible for the production of hydrochloric acid, which is a zinc-dependent enzyme. But the problem is if you've got low stomach acid, you can't often absorb zinc very efficiently, which then creates this vicious cycle where you don't have enough zinc to actually produce the right amounts of stomach acid. So that's something that we do look at and has been quite a successful strategy in my practice.
And how do you look at that? What do you do? Do you run tests? How?
Yeah. So it is a really tricky one. I do use, as I said before, history is a big one, so that will often point. So if there is a medication, then obviously that's a key indicator. Also, symptoms. So people who are experiencing those symptoms of burping, reflux, indigestion, those are the patients that I'm suspicious of, outside of the hyperacidic state, because the symptoms are quite similar. So sometimes it's not easy to differentiate. But we'll often do a trial with something like Biogest, which is a supplemental form of hydrochloric acid. It also has some digestive enzymes, pancreatic enzymes, I should say, and some and bile salts. So, and if my patients feel better with that, then it generally tells me that we're heading in the right direction. But the idea is not that you need to rely on supplements forever. It's about trying to restore balance back to that system.
So one of the avenues for SIBO to develop is issues with the stomach, and we've talked about the ileocecal valve as well, and actually you've done some work around my ileocecal valve, because I now know I'm full of adhesions. Yes. And I've got this huge mass around my ileocecal valve. Yeah. Which now explains a lot around why, one of the reasons why I've developed SIBO.
Yeah.
I've been talking to many people in recent times about adhesions, because to me it was such a light bulb awareness piece of going, oh my gosh, I didn't even know about these things and I'm full of them. because you do sort of manual therapy, you're multi-skilled in what you can do, but how can people sort of uncover whether they might have adhesions? And I do have full podcasts on them, so do go and listen to them. But just in your practice, how you would identify that?
Yeah, so it's quite an interesting area, because there are people who are specifically trained in treating adhesions and that's all they do in their practice, so that's their primary focus. I actually don't know of any practitioners around here that do that, but I know that you've had some experience in the States, certainly with that. Having said that, there are some links, and I remember at one of the conferences that we, the first one in Melbourne, we had I think she was a physiotherapist who does work with adhesions. So the work that I do is slightly different. Even though we're working on adhesions, it's actually coming from Chinese medical perspective and techniques that are based on reducing adhesions and scar tissue using acupuncture and also manual therapy. So there are many ways of attacking it, but they can be quite tricky to treat. They're obviously, because it's a structural issue, and scar tissue is hard to break down. So it can be done, but it does take time. And I would say, there are obviously degrees of adhesions as well, depending on what the patient's history is and how much surgery they've had or how much trauma they've had to the abdomen. All the way down to just simple issues with the ileocecal valve, which sometimes can be related to neurological stimulation. So there can be issues with the spine that mean that, that communication is not working properly, which affects nerve function. I will generally test all of my patients for that. And because I'm trained to treat or to feel abdomens, I know what a normal abdomen feels like. I know what an abnormal feeling abdomen is, and so for me it's quite obvious to my hands, but obviously you would want to go and seek someone who knows what they're doing, because it's not an easy thing to diagnose unless you're trained to do that and to know what you're feeling.
So alongside the ileocecal valve, are there any other key areas that you look at in terms of supporting a patient once you've cleared that excess bacteria?
Yeah. So for me, I normally talk about this idea that those gases that are being produced by the bacteria, whether they be methane or hydrogen or hydrogen sulfide, as being quite toxic. And so there is some research about this, but the idea that, you know, there is some functional and structural change that happens, or the functional change comes secondary to the structural change in the wall of the small intestine. So I normally draw a picture for my patients, but the wall of the bowel, the small bowel, is covered in finger-like projections called villi. And over those finger-like projections are hairs, which are called microvilli, and those have a secretory function. So they secrete enzymes and immune support and modulating factors into the lumen of the bowel. So if you have a stumping of those or a dysfunction in the structure of those fingers, that normally translates into changes in function of that that organ. And the small and the large intestine are actually quite different organs, even though they're connected and they are part of a long tube. Their function and structure are slightly different. And so the large intestine is a separate organ that is able to expand and contract. So I like to think of that like an accordion. So it is normal to have gas in the large intestine. Obviously, the degree of gas is questionable. You know, what's a normal amount of gas? That depends on what people are eating and the type of bacterial balance they have. But so having gas there doesn't actually cause any trouble, typically, outside of discomfort and possibly symptoms from pressure. But in the small bowel, as I said before, those hydrogen and methane gases are quite toxic. And if you do get change in the architecture in those fingers, you lose that secretory function, which means and a good example of where this can become a problem is in FODMAP intolerances, which I would suggest probably 95% of my patients with SIBO have. And often they come to me having already been to either a dietitian or other clinics where they're been diagnosed via breath testing, often through fructose and other, depending on what they've had done. But they come with that diagnosis, but what they've been told to do is to go away and just, you know, stop eating the foods that are causing them trouble. So, but often there's not much follow-up on that. So I found that quite interesting, because long-term, a low FODMAP diet is actually not very healthy for your large intestine ecology. So the bacteria, because FODMAPs are food for bugs, so if you're taking those foods away, then you will change that ecology. You'll affect their relative numbers and balance, and therefore that will have flow-on effect to, you know, systemic changes and also immune changes and all those things that are related to having healthy and abundant bacteria. Yeah.
Before we dive headfirst into the nutrition piece, because it is such an important piece and something that all of us with SIBO long for the day we can eat freely. It's what everybody says. I just want to be able to eat what I used to eat. But when I'm just wanting to kind of close the piece around, you know, how you would perhaps go about treating somebody that has low stomach acid, and perhaps there's an ileocecal valve dysfunction. You can see that there's multiple things at play that are contributing or could contribute to a SIBO relapse. How do you approach dealing with that? And then we'll move into what you do with food.
Yeah, sure. So again, obviously that depends on the history. I just wanted to firstly just finish up with that idea that the big focus of my follow-up after having cleared SIBO is actually to focus on restoring, because we've taken away that noxious influence, which is that damaging factor, which is the gases. So it's a bit like trying to say, well, you can't really repair a city while it's being bombed. So the first, you know, the trump card in treating all gut health issues is SIBO, in my opinion, because if you don't do that, then it prohibits you from really moving forward, because there's a lot of foods that you can't have again, because if you're eating fermentable foods and you've got bacteria in the wrong place, you're going to be creating gases, which will just exacerbate everything we've just talked about. So clearing that is obviously essential. And then what I normally focus on afterwards is if there is a stomach acid deficiency, or, you know, I normally try to help my patients come off proton pump inhibitors if it's relevant. And I've done that, you know, I've had quite a bit of experience doing that, and that is definitely possible. And a lot of people, I mean, proton pump inhibitors should not really be used long-term anyway, because they have quite a damaging effect on the body systemically long term through nutrient malabsorption and other factors. So, and even on the warnings on the packet, it says, you know, shouldn't be used for periods longer than 6 weeks. But as you probably know, as what I see in my practice is that once people are put on proton pump inhibitors, it's usually for life. So you can imagine what happens there. You know, you're opening up, you know, passage from bacteria, from your oral cavity, from food, to be coming in constantly, inoculating the small intestine with bacteria, and then, you know, setting up the likelihood of forming SIBO. So that's one factor. The other thing is obviously small bowel motility. So I know that's a big area of focus for lots of practitioners, and so I won't talk too much about it because I'm sure that that's been covered, but I do pay some attention to that because keeping the motility going is really important. But the autoimmune aspect of that, I'm not sure. I suspect that in doing what I'm about to talk about, that on some level that must be influencing that, and that, you know, that effect on the motor cells, because as I said to you earlier, I think, you know, those, it's hard for me to qualify the rates of relapse in my practice, but I would say that it's certainly nowhere near what you mentioned in you know, what you said before, and I think partly that is because, you know, SIBO's, everyone sort of kind of gets focused on the SIBO, but my question is always, well, if you've got SIBO, why have you got SIBO? And unless you ask that question, you can never really overcome that habit that will, you know, maybe form again. And so, you know, that really is where you have to be a little bit of a detective sometimes. Sometimes it's trial and error. But I think also coming back to fixing the wall of the small intestine, though I use lots of nutrients to do that. Zinc is my absolute favorite because it does repair a leaky gut by itself, as does glutamine, and there are a number of other agents, but they're my primary ones. The other thing is that in my practice I see very commonly a concurrent infection in the small bowel, often, and I think you've just done a webinar on this subject with my partner, which is yeast overgrowth. And that's a massive factor, and it can actually complicate being able to read the way the treatment's going. So I will always look into that in my practice, and if that's an issue, then we address that. But zinc certainly by itself is one of my favorite ways of treating an overgrowth of yeast, and it seems to be quite effective in high doses. So that's one aspect. And then obviously, as we talked about a little bit before, I will look at my patients' bellies and look at their history, if there's any possibility of adhesions. I generally try to address that with the body work that I do. And then after we've done that, at that point, we start to look at the balance of the large intestine and the ecology there. And so I'm now encouraging all of my patients, and most of them are doing it, some don't, but most of them do, go and get their stool tested through Ubiome, which is a relatively inexpensive thing to do now, but is so amazing in what it can give you compared to the archaic stool culturing methods, which show us, you know, maybe 0.5 to 5% of our total ecosystem. So we've missed, you know, the vast majority of the players, and now, you know, through the work of, you know, Jason Horlick and the research that's coming out now in abundance, the understanding of the types of bacteria that live in our colon, and the roles that they play are becoming more known. But it's certainly an evolving field. But yeah, the focus is then about trying to understand what the particular imbalances are in that Ubiome test. And what I find a lot in my practice is with a lot of, you know, as a result of the standard Western diet and lifestyle and stress and history of antibiotic use, that The diversity in lots of the patients that I've seen, their test results come through has been suboptimal. So not only that reduction in diversity, but also the balance of the skewing of bacteria towards the gram-negative bacteria. And the gram-negative bacteria are big players, and in a lot of my patients I see quite large numbers of those, and obviously that's not ideal because they all contain in their cell wall a something called a lipopolysaccharide, which is a fat. And like humans, they have a life cycle. All bacteria will eventually die, and when they die, the release of those lipopolysaccharides as the, you know, as the decay of that organism happens is released. And so obviously the more lipopolysaccharides, or the more gram-negative bacteria you have, the more lipopolysaccharides you're going to be producing, and those are well known now to cause leaky gut in their own right. So they're like dam busters. So they will break through, and once they're through, then they've got a passage into the bloodstream, which we now know rising of levels of lipopolysaccharides have been associated with lots of chronic inflammatory diseases, Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, cancer. You know, lots of chronic inflammatory conditions have been linked to high levels of LPS in the blood.
And I've just recently done my Ubiome test, and it's fascinating. It's so interesting to see what little critters are in there and in what percentage they're in there. One of the things that I think a lot about at this point in time, and it's something that has evolved over the last 3 years since I was diagnosed with SIBO, is just around feeding the broader microbiota within your whole gut ecosystem, rather than just being so focused on SIBO like I was for a long time. And obviously we talked about how FODMAPs play a really important role, but for many of the people listening today, they have been following a strict low FODMAP diet for years. And the moment that they deviate from that, they're crippled with symptoms. How do you get your patients to start expanding with their food?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey guys, do you feel completely overwhelmed when it comes to figuring out what you can eat that's suitable for a SIBO diet? I know that I felt so overwhelmed at the start of my SIBO journey. And let's be honest, eating for SIBO can be challenging. It can downright suck at points. You've already got so much going on. You've got your treatment, you're trying to remember to take all your medications and your supplements, and not to mention all of the daily symptoms that you have to experience, the pain, the bloating, the constipation or diarrhea or both, and the brain fog and exhaustion. The list just goes on. Having someone else take that hassle away from you for planning your food can make your day just that little bit easier. And this is where I've come to your rescue. I've developed SIBO meal plans just for you. They take all of the stress away from planning your SIBO daily food intake. They're based on the SIBO biphasic diet by Dr. Narala Jacoby, and each meal plan is just for the specific phase it relates to. So you may be on phase 1 restricted, or phase 1 semi-restricted, or phase 2 reduce and repair, and there is a meal plan just for you. We've got 14 days of SIBO-friendly meals and recipes included. There's weekly shopping lists, there's handy hints and tips to make cooking easier, and every recipe is 100% gluten-free. The recipes are low-grain. We only use a little bit of rice or quinoa in the recipes. depending on what phase you're following, of course. All the recipes are low carbohydrate, very low dairy, low sugar, and there are low FODMAP options included. The great news is that you can download it instantly and you can get cooking today. If you'd like to know more about the SIBO meal plans, head to thehealthygut.co/SIBO-meal-plans or head to the show notes from today's episode and just click on the link there. I hope you enjoy the meal plans, guys. I know it's going to save you so much time, energy and effort and help you be compliant to your SIBO diet as you go through your treatment. Now let's get back to the show. For many of the people listening today, they have been following a strict low FODMAP diet for years. And the moment that they deviate from that, they're crippled with symptoms. How do you get your patients to start expanding with their food?
Yeah. So slowly. So, and everyone's different. So I'll just talk in general terms. But so once the SIBO's cleared, it's like, you know, to some degree, you've got a clean slate. And at that point, you know, humans are complex and every patient is different and every case of SIBO is different. It has to be treated differently and unique. So some of them, you know, obviously with all that dysfunction that we were talking about just earlier, the potential for problems in many areas can come about. So there could be food sensitivities or sensitivities to chemicals in foods like salicylates and amines. And so, I mean, all of that is just a symptom of dysfunction and a system that's not in balance. So if those are obvious, then obviously we try to restrict those in the short term. But ultimately, I think coming back to that bacterial balance in the long term, the greater the diversity, the greater the balance in favor of, you know, the more the gram positives and those that aren't pro-inflammatory. They also, the nutrients that we take in and the absorption of nutrients is dependent on that balance of bacteria as well. So in the long term, getting that, ultimately getting to that point where you can rearrange that ecosystem to work for you rather than against you is one of the best things you can do to improve tolerances. So because if you've cleared the SIBO and you've done good gut repair, your functioning capacity of that organ system should have improved. The other thing that I've seen in my practice quite a lot, which was quite surprising when I first saw it, and you don't read about this very much, but I have seen where lots of my patients are now eating foods that they couldn't conceive of eating before, and tying that to the FODMAPs. So, you know, apples and onions and things like that, I've got patients who are now eating, which, you know, before that would have, you know, been a horrendous thought to even eat a small amount of those. So the potential is there. But as I said, it is complex and how you get there, and it depends obviously on how committed you are and the complexity of your case. But I would say that normally the idea is to try and improve the diversity in your diet as soon as possible, but doing it very slowly. So I do use, even during the SIBO treatment, I know a lot of people use just the biphasic diet. I'm not dogmatic about what I do in my practice. I just try and do what's easiest for my patients. So I tend to break a lot of the rules of, you know, that you hear around, just trying to make it easier because it's notoriously hard to treat. It's hard to commit to. It's low sugar, so energy is an issue for my patients, as you would probably, most of your listeners would know. So I try to get to the point where we can be eating some, you know, relatively low fermentable carbohydrates as soon as possible to try and improve the energy status of the patient so that then they can actually allow themselves to make those changes or have the, you know, the motivation to make the changes. Because if you're tired, it's very hard to make any decisions, let alone about preparing foods, and because we're talking about eating whole foods. But one of the things that you know, there is an urgency to get away from those diets, because I don't think there's a healthy diet on the planet long term. So I think in my mind, there's just healthy eating and there's healthy foods. And so keeping it simply, I think, you know, the more diversity of, you know, fruits and vegetables and, you know, predominantly a plant-based diet seems to be what is the healthiest for human guts. And certainly, you know, diets like the paleo diet which when it's done balanced, I think is a very good diet. But I think a lot of people get obsessed with the protein and fat components, and they're well known to disrupt the balance of the gut of the large intestine bacteria. So, and they will skew that balance towards the gram negative bacteria, which then produces inflammation. And so long term, that's not a healthy diet either. So I think, you know, if you can aim to have the most diversity in your vegetable intake, some fruits, so that's kind of my goal. And I think the quicker we can do that, the better, because I've heard of patients being on, you know, the SIBO diet and low FODMAP diets long term, and they have obvious negative effects on your health as well. Plus, you know, I guess with diversity you get diversity of nutrients as well. Yeah. So, yes.
And Dr. Jason Horlack, you know, in his initial, he and I have had a session now after waiting for 12 months to see him. And one of his guidelines is 40 or more plant-based foods. So plants, so vegetables as we know them, fruits, seeds, nuts and legumes, 40 or more per week. And I eat a lot of vegetables. I've got my partner and I have actually decided this year, after being vegetarian for 7 years and then doing the SIBO diet and doing paleo, I felt like I'd just eaten way too much meat. So we're actually bringing back in just strict vegetarian meals into our week so that we're not eating protein every single meal. And that's definitely going to help me get to 40 or more vegetables, but it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot of
It is.
Different things to eat.
Yeah, and it's all whole food, so you have to prepare all of that, which goes back to what I was saying earlier is, you know, if someone's tired and you know, hasn't been, you know, feeding themselves well because of, you know, lack of ability because of food reactions, it is, you know, it's a very strong priority to get that repair done, because, you know, that large intestine balance is totally dictated to by the health of everything upstream, because you can't go and feed that stuff before you clean up, you know, the upstream stuff. And so there is a very kind of logical progression in the treatment in my eyes. And but I think also if I do focus at the beginning of the treatment on firstly trying to establish a number of foods that patient can have safely. And so the reason I do that first before giving supplements is that then we always have a safe place for them to go, because the treatments can get very complex. And when you're taking multiple supplements and introducing different foods, it's very hard to read exactly what's going on. So I think I don't like to rush the treatment, and I know some people are keen to get the treatment done faster for obvious reasons, but I think if you can maintain a clear and methodical method to treatment and have that safety pad all the time, and I ask my patients to keep quite detailed notes so that there's no confusion, you know, after not seeing someone for 2 or 3 weeks, it's very easy to forget what was working, what was aggravating, what wasn't. So I do encourage my patients to do that so that we can maintain clarity. But the idea is after SIBO is cleared, that and after we've done, you know, probably on average about a month to, you know, 6 weeks of some very strong focused effort on trying to repair the villi and the microvilli, is then to start to reintroduce some foods slowly. And I usually guide that by another diet protocol for treating SIBO called the fast track diet. So I do cherry pick from that and try to stay in the sort of the green and amber sections of those. But white potatoes, like Desiree potatoes, are very low fermentable. They're not on the biphasic diet, but that's something that I find a lot of my patients have a lot of joy when they are able to reintroduce that. And also you can, you know, making potato salads and allowing that resistant starch to form by cooling potatoes after they've been heated is also a benefit long term for getting that that balance in the bacteria in the large bowel. Yeah.
I think one of the frustrations for a SIBO patient is that there's no one diet
yes.
for a person to follow. Diets can seem to be contradictory to each other.
Yep.
You know, the fast track diet allows potatoes. The SIBO biphasic diet doesn't include potatoes. It can be really, you can feel like no one really knows what they're doing.
Yep.
How do you handle patients that are, you know, perhaps in that zone where they're feeling really frustrated that they can't just be given a sheet and told what to do?
Yeah. So that's why it's a strong focus, is to try and get them to the point where they have enough food at their disposal that they can actually get through a day without having to struggle too much. So, yeah, it is tricky. But that's why, you know, when we first started using the biphasic diet, and this is not a criticism of it, it's just what I found in my practice. So, you know, there is no one system. So, but I started, you know, we would be have my patients doing it quite strictly at the beginning in the, you know, the first section of that, which is quite restrictive and certainly not easy to sustain because it's very low carbohydrate. So, but in that, patients were still getting bloated and feeling uncomfortable in their abdomen, which kind of was a bit strange to me because, you know, we're trying to reduce fermentability. So why is that happening? And so I started looking into what that might be. And I realized, and with the help of the fast track diet, which is it was a fermentability ranking system of foods, and I started experimenting with that. So, and I you know, I'd be curious. I haven't really looked into the science behind it, but I've certainly, you know, as a clinician, I'm trying to, you know, have my patients feel better quickly. So we started looking at what could potentially be causing the problems. And so I noticed immediately that carrot was one of the most highly fermentable vegetables there. So, you know, I think it ranks sort of at 10 points, whereas you know, the Desiree potato was a one or a zero. So I started experimenting and taking that out of my patients' diets and was having some success there with doing that. So that allowed me then to start to consider, you know, that as an option as well. So I do use both. I try to increase portion size as well. So if my patients are comfortable with in their gut with the foods that are on any of those, whether it's the biphasic or the fast track, then I encourage them to just eat a little bit more as well. Obviously, during the treatment, I think it's important not to eat all the time. I think having periods of fasting is good for the migrating motor complex, so that's beneficial. But the other thing that that struck me as interesting was that in the rices, you can have basmati or jasmine rice in the biphasic diet, but if you look at the fermentability profile of those two rices, they're quite profoundly different. Jasmine has a zero fermentability, and I think basmati, don't quote me, is around 10 or 11 as well. So I absolutely don't have my patients have any basmati rice and just stick to jasmine rice. And lots of patients are intolerant to rice, so, you know, that's why there's no one size for everyone, but those things have been useful just to try and encourage my patients to continue. And the other thing that I do that may be slightly different is I tend to retest much sooner than a lot of other practitioners, because what I found was that we were having patients doing long, you know, treatment session, you know, periods, so, you know, maybe 8 weeks, and then get the test results back and find that, you know, for some reason that the levels of gas had not really reduced to my satisfaction. And so that's a long time to be taking stuff that's expensive, and if it's not helping, then what are you doing? So now I routinely retest after 1 month. And the reason I do that is because if there is a reduction in gas in that period, then it means that the treatment is working, and then we can then calculate how long the treatment might be need to go for after that. And I generally don't retest again after that. So, yeah. There are exceptions to that, but for the most part, that's what I do.
And I have personally found comparing the diets, you know, I followed the biphasic diet. I've written cookbooks on the biphasic diet. I know it well, but I found that Once I'd become a little bit more comfortable around what I was eating, that looking at, say, the low FODMAP diet, the fast track diet by Dr. Norm Robillard, really helped to explain why certain foods on the biphasic diet still didn't agree with me. And I was one of those patients, I could not tolerate basmati rice, but I'd think, but it's on the list, I should be able to eat it. And then I learned about the fast track diet, and there was basmati rice as a very fermentable grain. And for anyone who's listening, if you'd like to hear Dr. Norm Robillard talk about the fast track diet, that's episode 18. So head back to that episode and take a listen, because he does explain it well, and it was really helpful to me to understand, or to kind of explain some of my symptoms that were present despite the fact that I was tolerating food pretty well.
Yeah, it's very common. So you know, it's not an easy area to work in. I think you know that it's complex, and you know, you speak to enough people who are doing it. It's not easy, and but you know, given the research now is pointing to, you know, SIBO as being potentially up to, you know, sort of 80% of all IBS. It's a massive issue, and it's you know, it's certainly not in the, you know, the orthodox medical camp. There's nothing of that they do for it, so it does leave it up to practitioners out there. But there's a lot of, as you can tell just by what we've talked about, there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of conflicting information, and so, you know, for me out here with my patients, I'm doing my best, and you know, sometimes we get it right, hopefully more than not. I would say, you know, there's sort of that 10 to 15% of patients who, for whatever reason, you know, some of my patients we discover have, you know, if it's a stubborn case, then we're looking at, you know, a lot of cases where their inflammatory bowel disorders are also there underlying. So they may have SIBO, and in fact I've got quite a few cases where there's been SIBO, and subsequently found out that they had either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. And you know, these things are complicated, and you know, food sensitivities is massive, and but I think most people, you know, who follow the protocols that we just talked about, and follow through with that repair program, and then, you know, finally getting to the large bowel, which I see is kind of the final frontier. For those people, there's some huge rewards in following through with it. Not everyone's convinced of that at the beginning, and you know, they get frustrated with the restrictions. But I think, obviously with experience, you can find, you know, where those little tricks are, that, you know, that when you're first starting out practicing doing this work, it's incredibly confusing. And you know, I still get confused, but I'm getting less confused as the years go on. So,
well, it's really, you know, it feels like a bit of a final frontier, understanding the gut. And it's only in very recent times that there's been a lot more talk on TV and programs, for gut and gut health and the microbiota. I know when I first started out with this journey, it was just not on the radar at all. So to recap, as you've talked about, and correct me if I get any of this wrong, the real process for you as a practitioner is to first and foremost clear SIBO, because without clearing that, the gases are going to remain damaging and causing havoc in the gut.
Yep.
Healing the gut, looking at what else is contributing. So is there stomach acid issues? Are there adhesions at play? Are there other inflammatory conditions that might be keeping the system inflamed? And then finally moving into the replenishment, or just refeeding of the large bowel, and looking at what the diversity is. And yep, we can talk a little bit about Eubiome Explorer, which is, yep, the test that I've done, and I know we're going to do a podcast on that itself. Mm-hmm. But just around a description that Dr. Narala Jacoby once said, which I thought was great, was that your gut is like an incredible rainforest, and you just don't want your gut to be made up all of ferns or all of, you know, big tall trees. It needs to have a huge variety of trillions of different things living in it. Yep. And I always think then about my rainforest in my gut.
Yes.
How are you going, little rainforest? And now I know with my Eubiome that my diversity is 62%. Obviously, optimal is ideal, perfect score would be 100.
Yeah.
So I've got some plants and trees and ferns and creatures missing out of my system.
Yeah, and you know, it's a big issue now because, you know, we're sort of the second generation of antibiotics now, and the detrimental effect that that has had on human beings shouldn't be underestimated. You know, the majority of us is foreign DNA and bacteria, so we are a very small host for a massive ecosystem, and it's not any different to the planet. So even though antibiotics have saved a lot of lives, they've also created a lot of problems, and you know, we're sort of coming to the end of our ability to use them efficiently, with the growth in resistance and superbugs, formation. So there is a real scramble at the moment to try and find other antimicrobials, because we're heading back to the dark ages, unfortunately, with our treatments. But what it's also done is, and I've seen, you know, families where this has been, you know, highlighted, where subsequent generations, because it's, you know, your bacteria is essentially set up from birth, and so now with, you know, the alarming rise in cesarean births, you know, obviously if you have to have a cesarean birth, I'm not suggesting that it's a bad thing, but we are seeing many more than we used to. And as a result of that, you're not getting that natural transition through the birth canal, which is that initial coating of bacteria to the infant, which then, you know, when the mother starts breastfeeding, and that's another part that's often not neglected, but some women aren't able to breastfeed, or some choose not to. So for whatever reason it is, without judging that, the breast milk is high in galactosaccharide, which is it's like a turbo boost for bacterium. So if you don't have that initial coating, and then, you know, the follow-up with the breast milk, you don't get that foundation. And you're only getting the bacteria, if that happens, you're only getting the bacteria that the mother has. And if she's come from, you know, a history or a background where she's had multiple exposures to antibiotics over her life or in utero or whatever, then that is going to be passed on. And so every subsequent generation then is having this, you know, reduced diversity, and the health implications of that we're only just beginning to realize. And there's a lot of work being done in this field right now. So it's very difficult that idea of, you know, I used to think that you could take probiotics and re-inoculate your gut. Well, we now know that that's not true. In fact, the vast majority of probiotics don't actually colonize. They pass through and perform functions. So while you're taking them, they will have an effect, and that effect stops once you finish. So they are useful for treating conditions and for maintaining, for controlling symptoms. But you also have to, underneath that, taking those is really feed that ecosystem with the fertilizer. And that's the prebiotics and colonic foods that you touched on, you know, the polyphenols and, you know, things that give color, diversity of vegetables and you know, fruits and plants, really. Legumes as well, but, you know, it's complex with SIBO patients because, you know, those are the things, they're like poison. So it has to be done at the end, because if you do it early, you'll just aggravate everything. But I think, you know, for those that get through and can, you know, the eubiome test is just such a profound test in what it shows us now. And the take-home message is that ecosystem can be restored somewhat. You know, the only way at this stage of re-inoculating bacteria is through fecal microbial transplant, but you can influence that diversity, or I should say the numbers and the balance of that ecosystem from what you have, by choosing, you know, better foods to consume. And, you know, it's not a short-term diet, it has to be a long-term shift, because as soon as you shift away from that, your ecosystem will change accordingly. So if you went back to a high protein, high fat diet after having eaten lots of vegetables and legumes and prebiotics, it will shift back over time. And so I guess the take home for that is that educating patients on shifting their understanding of what foods are and how they affect their health, so that they can make more permanent changes to the choices that they make, is really important.
And I think that's one of the things that comes with the passage of time with dealing with SIBO. In the early days, many people saying things like, and they say it to me, I'll get through my treatment as quickly as possible and I just want to get back to normal, what is has been their normal. And what generally happens with people is that their normal shifts, as it has with mine, and your new normal, you can't imagine in the early days that that will ever become your normal, because why would you, you don't see the purpose of eating like that. But now, you know, years down the track for me, 3 years down the track, my new normal is very different, and I really enjoy the way my new normal is. Yeah, and how it absolutely makes me feel.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Chris, thank you so much for coming back onto the Healthy Gut. Not back onto it. You've been on my SIBO coaching program, and then I've finally been able to get some time in your very busy schedule for the SIBO, for the Healthy Gut podcast. Getting my two things confused. I'm hoping that we're going to come back for a future podcast episode to talk about Ubiome and my results, and share with my listeners a little bit about what they said about me.
Yep.
I've touched on it, and then what things look like as we progress through time, because we will be actively working on my on the diversity of my gut, which I'm really excited
about. Watch.
Yeah, I love really being a science experiment.
Yes, indeed.
Chris, if people want to reach out and connect with you, how can they make contact?
Yeah, so either through our clinic, which is Resonance Therapy in Melbourne. So we have a website, which is www.resonancetherapy.com.au, or if they want to email, which is also on the website, my email address is Chris, so C-H-R-I-S, at Resonance, R-E-S-O-N-A-N-C-E, therapy.com.au. So Chris at resonancetherapy.com.au.
And all of those links are in the show notes, including the link for the Ubiome test. It's $89, so it is not expensive at all.
Well worth your money.
It's well worth it, but you do need someone who knows what they're doing to help interpret it, because there's a lot of data. But thank you so much for coming onto the Healthy Gut podcast today.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed my episode today with Chris. He is just such a phenomenal practitioner and a wealth of knowledge. If you would like to get today's show notes, make sure you head to thehealthygut.co/life-after-SIBO. And you can get the full transcription from today's show simply by joining up as a member. It's absolutely free to do that. All you need to do is add your name and email address in the membership section on the show notes page, and you will get an email with the transcription from today's episode and all episodes from season 2. So it's absolutely fantastic if you like to read along, make notes to the valuable information you get for free from the Healthy Gut podcast. Now, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, Pinterest, Google+. We are really active on social media platforms, and we absolutely love connecting with you there. So come say hi. All you need to do is look for us under The Healthy Gut. And coming up on next week's show, I will finally be bringing you my nutrition webinar podcast. I have been saying I'd be bringing this to you for a couple of weeks. Apologies, guys. It got put to the side while we brought the amazing interview with Dr. Mark Pimentel to you last week, and now Chris's this week. So tune in next week as I talk about my second key pillar to health, nutrition. You've been listening to the Healthy Gut podcast with your host, Rebecca Coombs. To learn more about the Healthy Gut or our podcast, head to thehealthygut.co/podcast. And as we are fully funding this podcast, if you would like to help support the continuation of this podcast so that we can continue to bring you future episodes, All you need to do is make a contribution at thehealthygut.co/podcast. We would like to thank Red Lemon Productions for the production and original music score of this podcast. To find out more about their services, head to redlemonproductions.com. The Healthy Gut Podcast is a production of The Healthy Gut. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.